Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. In particular, one of tonight's tales is centered on chronic child abuse. Listener discretion is advised. Hello again, friends, and welcome to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. Tonight, I have two stories to send a nice electric chill down your spine. To start, we'll be reading 20 Mile Chances by A.W. Mason. Our narrator, Ken, lives a seemingly normal life in a near-future version of America. He has a job and a family, but he dearly misses his father, who passed when he was very young. Now, Ken has stumbled across an opportunity to possibly bring his father back from the dead. The only question is, how far, literally, is Ken willing to go to make that happen? After that, we have The Swan by Travis Brown. Here, our protagonist relates a story of his childhood following the sudden death of his parents. After moving in with his grandmother in the countryside, he meets Penny, the young girl who lives next door. Penny has two things that immediately jump out to our narrator: a well-loved swan stuffed animal that she always has with her, and a drunken, abusive father. As the years go by, Penny's situation worsens until these two elements finally come together in a bizarre and unexpected conclusion. Folks, I found this one to be particularly engrossing and heart-wrenching, and I hope that it hits you the same way that it hit me. Also, quickly here before we jump in, I wanted to let you know that Chilling Tales has put out its own book of short stories. Head over to www.chillingbook.com to take a look, and maybe just order a copy of your own. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author A.W. Mason, I give you 20-mile chances. It was Tuesday when I first saw the giant screen flash the advertisement. The screen, perhaps 10 stories tall and as long as a football field, reminded me of the one that used to be in Times Square, a place I studied in history lessons as a child but never had the chance to visit before it was destroyed. The big cities burned first: New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Dallas. It wasn't a sudden thing, and it wasn't a quick thing, but rather an event that took years of tension, malicious rhetoric, and sanctions against our political adversaries before war flooded America like a burst dam. This all happened when my parents were still young, before I was even thought of. It was also the first time since yet another archaic war, Vietnam if I recall correctly, that the draft was reinstated. Unluckily for my father, he was part of the second wave of draftees called up once he came of age. Now, obviously, he didn't die right away. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here to tell you this story. In fact, while he was fighting in the war, he and my mother wed, and while on leave, consummated their marriage. And as a result, here I am. All this a decade after he had been drafted and close to 15 years since the war had begun. However, my father did die. I was 4 years old. My mother received a call from the vice president himself with the news and a quick thank you for his service. Ironically, the vice president was assassinated not a year after, along with the president and most of his cabinet, in an orchestrated coup by our own military. It seems our political adversaries had infiltrated the administration to the point of installing their own new America government. At least, that's what I read about in the history books growing up, and gleaned from secondhand stories my mother and her side of the family told when we were able to get together. New America, for the most part, is all I've ever known. Now, I'm not saying it's Orwellian by any means, but the stories my uncles have told me, tales of democracy and freedom of expression and about a million other things, those ideals are starkly different from anything that I've learned in any school curriculum. But here I am. I'm provided for, I've been placed into the workforce, I have a wife now and a child. There's no more war. And if you adhere to state regulations, you should be free of any trouble. I get to see my mother and my uncles about once a month. I wish it were more, but that's just the way things are. I value that time, however, because it's through them that I've been able to create an image of my father, one that I'm old enough now to understand and appreciate. I know it isn't the same as having him here. I regret that he's gone. I miss him a hell of a lot. But he would have to live on in spirit alone, and I'd come to accept that. That was until Tuesday, when I read the advertisement that slowly scrolled along the giant screen downtown. I had just gotten off work. 9 solid hours of data mining had my mind close to mush, and I was looking forward to a run when I arrived home. The New America Coalition was high on fitness, just as much as technology. So when I saw the screen before I got on the bus ride home, I stopped dead in my tracks and reread the scrawl maybe a dozen times. 20 miles, a 10K shy of a marathon. Not far, considering the reward. A coalition subsidiary, Lefton Reanimation Corps, was sponsoring a 20-mile race, which in and of itself wasn't very surprising considering our mandatory physical training. But this particular alphabet agency focused on a technology that I hadn't thought possible. Resurrection. And that was the reward. Win the race, bring back to life a soul who is passed on. Although later, many folks thought the event was just a big marketing ploy to show off the new technology to the rest of the world, I saw the chance to see my father again. The entire bus ride home, I pondered the possibilities. My father meeting his grandson, his daughter-in-law, seeing his own wife again. I thought about hugging him, actually holding on to him, something more than a memory. There would be so much to cover, so much to talk about. The New America Coalition, antebellum memories, and post-war living. I walked into my home, still considering the likelihood of this special chance. My wife, Lena, had just gotten home as well from her position at the Coalition's welfare facility, and I told her about what I had discovered. With her support, I sat down at the computer module in the corner of the living room and logged into LRC's platform site to read the details of the event. Pretty simple, I thought. The race would be a televised event sponsored by the Coalition and LRC to award a victor the opportunity to bring back a deceased person from their family. It had to be a familial relation due to the necessity of DNA formulation between the departed and the living. That worked out perfectly in my book. The race was limited to 25 participants, and they would be chosen based on a lottery draw. If selected, participants would have a week to train before the race was held, which would be in 2 weeks' time at Hayworth Park. The remaining guidelines were vague: no age or class divisions, no restrictions on gear or supplements, if you had any access to them. I entered my name, submitted the form, pushed myself away from the monitor, and stared. My mind swam with fantastic scenarios. Being chosen, becoming the victor, seeing my father again. Sleep that night came slowly. My brain wouldn't shut off, regardless of the sheep I counted. Work the next day was rough, but I labored through it, and honestly, the week after seemed like a blur. Every day before traveling home, I read the LRC race advertisement, hoping like hell the entrants would be few and my chances of being chosen would be many. On draft day, I rolled out of bed after a sleepless night filled with anxiety about being selected. I pushed around the powdered eggs and toast on my plate, my appetite gone, vacationing somewhere with the sleep I needed. The television in the background finally finished up with the state news and segued into the chairman from LRC, thanking the coalition for the race sponsorship. On the screen, the chairman reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a rectangular piece of paper. The names. I shoved my plate away, stood up, and walked over to the television. Lena crept up behind me as our son, Nathan, still slept soundly down the hall. She wrapped her arms around my midsection and waited with me for the lucky participants to be called.
"And now, for the moment most of you have been waiting for," the chairman began. "LRC has randomly chosen 25 citizens from the thousands of you who have so graciously entered the lottery."
My heart sank a little. I knew there would be plenty of folks interested in signing up, but I wanted so badly for the draft pool to be as small as possible.
"Our first participant is Sean O'Hara. Next, we have Gregory Arbuckle, followed by Jennifer Milton," the chairman said from his podium on the screen.
Lena's hold around me became tighter as more names were read off, the total drawing closer to 25. I sighed and closed my eyes as the chairman prepared to call out the final name.
"And lucky number 25 is Antonio Torres. I want to personally thank each and every one of you who entered. Do not be disheartened if your name wasn't called. Instead, have comfort in knowing that one of these participants will soon have the opportunity of a lifetime."
Lena kissed the back of my neck as I switched off the television. She released me, gently turned me around, and stared into my eyes. Her look said everything I needed to see. A message without words that lovers could share after years and years of practice. I pulled her into me, living in her warmth, and said, "It's probably for the best." All week long, I buried myself in my work. I stayed late and avoided the water cooler talk as well as the continuous commotion of LRC's race hype. Admittedly, I was still sour about the situation. I had gotten my hopes up when I knew that I should have been smarter. Lena kept Nathan occupied as I worked on even more data mining from the home computer to keep my mind off the race. It would fade, this feeling of envy and depression, but for now, I needed to keep myself busy. On Thursday of that week, I was back at my home computer, crunching numbers for the coalition. Lena was in the living room, reading a picture book to Nathan as the television streamed ambience in the background. However, a familiar sound, the sound of the state news breaking into regular broadcast with a special bulletin, chimed its way into my ears. I got up from my workstation and sat on the couch with Lena and Nathan. Nathan patted my arm and smiled up at me.
His sandy hair and cherub-like cheeks looked a lot like the photographs of myself when I was around his age, only his eyes were different. His eyes were my father's eyes. We apologize for interrupting your normally scheduled broadcast, but we have a dire announcement to make. Tamika Harris, participant number 19 for Saturday's LRC's 20-mile race, has suddenly perished. Details at this hour are scarce, but it is believed that Harris suffered a heart attack while training for the competition and did not recover. Lena, eyes still on the television, squeezed my forearm. There will be an emergency drawing from the pool of entrants who were not initially chosen to act as her replacement. Please stand by for contact from the coalition, and of course, we will all keep Tamika Harris in our thoughts. Thank you. We will now return you. The phone rang. Lena's grip on my forearm tightened, almost to the point of a tingling numbness, and we looked at each other. The phone rang again. Neither of us moved. Neither of us could move. It felt like an eternity before the next ring echoed through the foyer. I sprang up, knocking Nathan's picture book from Lena's lap, and ran to the phone. Light from the hall seemed to cast a spotlight on the beige plastic handset in front of me. I grabbed the receiver and answered. Hello?
Hello, yes. May we speak with a Mr. Kensington Campbell?
Asked the voice on the other end of the phone.
Hi, yes, this is Ken speaking. Great. Mr. Campbell, my name is Gordon Frederick, and I'm reaching out to you on behalf of the Left and Reanimation Corps. As I'm sure you're aware, we have a slot open in our upcoming event, the 20-mile race, this Saturday at Hayworth Park, due to some most unfortunate circumstances.
I paused, swallowed, and tried to speak.
Yes, I've just heard, actually.
I looked at Lena, whose eyes had widened to the size of large steel ball bearings.
Great. Well, we were perusing our list of candidates from the lottery pool, and your name was randomly chosen after we had a few entrants decline to replace our fallen runner. Can we count on you to fill the position?
I know it's such a terribly short notice, not much time to train, I'm afraid, but just think of the potential reward. My heartbeat made a crescendo in my chest. Sweat stood out in droplets above my eyebrows, and a cool chill surged through my body. My throat was dry, but I licked my lips and was able to respond.
Yes, of course,
I replied, almost in a scream. I happened to glance at Lena again, who smiled back at me so wide I could see her perfectly white molars.
Great, the phone voice said again. All the information you'll need regarding arrival time and race day preparations will be sent to your state email address. Please check your home computer in a few minutes to review and accept the terms. Questions can be directed to the phone number listed in the email. Thank you, Mr. Campbell, for accepting this greatest of opportunities. We look forward to seeing you on Saturday. Before I could respond, before I could say thank you, the line clicked off and went dead. I placed the phone receiver back into its cradle and looked at my wife. We both had tears running their courses down our cheeks, dumb smiles catching the salty rivers.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
The coalition granted me Friday off from work for the purpose of race preparation, what little I could do in one day. I was lucky to have taken the state's mandatory fitness program so enthusiastically. My endurance felt good. 20 miles wasn't out of the realm of possibility for me to finish, although I did not have any information on the folks I would be racing against. Instead, I decided to focus on myself, mentally prepare, and try to get as much rest as I could. I knew sleep would be a challenge for me, if I'd get any at all, so I decided to turn in early in the hopes that the Sandman would visit. When my alarm went off early Saturday morning, I was surprised and disconnected from a deep sleep as I slapped at the device to cease its bleeding. Feeling more rested than anticipated, I arose, stretched my arms, and went to turn on the shower.
Steam quickly fogged the mirror, and I could hear Lena already off in the kitchen preparing my breakfast. On the bathroom sink counter, there was a jar of petroleum jelly, which, after the shower, I applied to any area of my body where friction normally occurred. For longer runs, chafing and bleeding could cut your progress to the point of crawling in raw pain. I dressed in my state-issued tech fabric racewear and carefully tied a bandana around my brow to protect my bald head from sunburn. Lena had placed a plate on the table with slices of fresh mango, avocado, and wheat toast. Nathan sat in his high chair across from me, sucking milk from his sippy cup. A small pale rivulet flowed from the corner of his mouth. He burped, then laughed. Nathan, regardless of most situations, seemed to always have the innate ability to bring a smile to my face. And how I hoped like hell my own father would see the joy that this child brings me. The Coalition sent a private car to retrieve my family. The trip was a short one. Hayworth Park was a mere 10 miles from our house. What I saw when we crested the sloping hill into the park went beyond what I had imagined race day would hold in store. Thousands of cheering spectators lined the path to the race entrance, waving small, handheld New America flags. They cheered into the overcast morning. Riser seating had been constructed and placed for what looked like great lengths of the course. The state news outlet had already begun their on-site broadcast for the event, and I even spied foreign press, a rarity for the Coalition to allow. Wide electric screens flanked the seating risers, showing the race coverage as it unfolded. Above me, I heard a helicopter hovering. The driver pulled away from the front of the park and into a corded-off staging area where we were instructed to exit the car and check in with the concierge at the platform near the end of a big white tent. From there, Lena and Nathan were consigned to a family viewing area, and I was corralled into a room with the other runners who had already arrived. When the final participant joined us minutes later, the chairman entered from a door flap in the big white tent structure, and the room became silent. The chairman walked in and stood before us, smiling.
"Good morning, race contestants. I'm sure you're all very anxious to get this race started, so let me not keep you too long, huh?" the chairman began. "We at LRC have developed a cutting-edge technology, one we want to share with the world, and, of course, one that we want to share with you. We want to reconnect you with people from your past, people you may have never met, people you may have never had a chance to say goodbye to or say I love you to one last time. This new technology is going to change not only New America as we know it, but it is going to change the world. So, why have a race to showcase our new discovery? It's very simple. Money. This research and development has created a huge cost, and the more we develop this technology, the greater that cost will be. Hopefully, in the years to come, it will become more affordable for everyone. But now, with this event and the worldwide exposure you all will likely create, the funds necessary to continue our cause will be raised to a global level, and we will have investors lining up at our proverbial door. We are also a philanthropic body, aren't we? We want to give the chance to one of our loyal citizens to experience this technology free of charge. Really, for you and for the Coalition, it's a win-win situation. Listen to me rambling on. I apologize. Before we disperse, what questions are there?" For a short time, the room remained silent. The runners stood like statues, myself included, either in awe of what was about to happen or in shock that they were one of the 25 people competing in this unique competition. I was part of the latter. But an arm did shoot up in the back. The chairman nodded to a scrawny, pimply-faced kid who couldn't have been much older than 18. "Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman. I read through the event contract and signed it with enthusiasm. However, I was poring over it again last night, reading the fine print, if you will. The section under regulations stated that this is a non-regulated sanctioned event. What does that mean exactly?" the kid asked. The chairman smiled, exposing a neat row of square teeth. I could have sworn at that moment his eyes narrowed to slits and the devil himself had manifested in the man. It wasn't far from the truth, knowing what I know now.
"These people, these viewers, and the world at large want to see a show, don't they?"
It can only dramatically increase the exposure for what our endeavor serves. This is indeed a non-regulated sanctioned event. That means you have the freedom, and I do underline that word, freedom, to compete how you see fit, whatever works best for you. Each racer must run the full 20 miles, but how you get to the finish line, well, that's up to you, the chairman said. A murmur among the contestants broke out. The pimply-faced kid raised his hand again, and once more the chairman nodded to him. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Is there any other clarification you can give us on that? Why, sure, the chairman said, the smile dropping from his face. Now, we are not condoning or suggesting you go out and commit acts of heinous violence against one another, he began, winking dramatically at the crowd. But if someone were to trip, maybe accidentally knocked over, well, the race isn't going to stop. A tall man with a stone face, dressed in a black suit, leaned in toward the chairman and whispered into his ear. The chairman nodded, patted the man on the back, and turned back toward us. I've been informed that it's time to shuffle you out to the starting line. Once again, I thank you for your participation, and just keep in mind all the good you're about to do for the coalition. Good luck to you all, and may the best man or woman be victorious. The chairman exited the podium, pausing to relay something to the same stone-faced man from earlier. The man nodded and walked through our crowd to the back. We were ushered single file from the tent, and as I approached the exit flap, I craned my neck behind me, seeing not only the other solemn-looking souls, but also the stone-faced man transfer something to a runner at the end of the line. It was a smooth transition, like a sleight of hand by a veteran magician, and I'm certain now that I must have been the only one to see it. What it was, I wasn't sure, but it glinted under the lights of the tent, the shiny metal quickly concealed by the runner's hand. I tried to speak up, to say something, but was guided, forcefully, by another man in a black suit toward the starting line. Outside, the skies remained their same shade of dirty gray, threatening to rain. The crowds were raucous, and the giant screens blared out the state's broadcast in deafening decibels. My vision blurred, and my palms started to sweat. The noises around me became muffled. Shoulder to shoulder, I lined up next to my fellow runners, trying to focus on the race, but my mind fired off in a million different directions, pulled by phantom hands. We stood there, in front of the raging crowd, for what seemed like an eternity. Until finally, a shot rang out, cracking through the sky, signaling the start of the race. At first, I didn't move. I couldn't. I felt racers brushing past me, maneuvering around the spot in the ground that magnetized me. A runner pushed me from behind, breaking my trance, and my legs began to pump. The adrenaline coursed through my veins, and my pace became too quick. I labored for breath, catching up to the running mob, and established my normal gait. Once I had settled down and found my pace, I scanned the area around me, noticing that the crowds lining the running course thinned out as we trudged farther along. The hovering cameras broadcasting the event live to a television audience across New America, and probably the world, kept pace with the front group, of which I was a part. Another hovering camera lagged behind, collecting images of those bringing up the rear. After 10 miles, it became clear who my real competition was. I stayed among the leaders, rotating within the top four as the miles added up. The crowds, now just sporadic pockets of people along the course, shouted out updates to us as we passed by them. Of the 25 entrants, 10 had quit, forfeiting their chance at LRC's amazing reward, and three others ceased due to injury and muscle cramps. Still, I was a top five runner and hoped to keep my position at least until the last mile when I could really turn it on. And that was the only thing on my mind until I heard about the first death occurring with 7 miles left. At first, I thought a runner must have suffered a massive stroke or perhaps a heart attack like Tamika Harris had in her training. After all, those kinds of things did happen, and even to the fittest of people.
I also didn't want to believe what the crowds were shouting to us, what the other runners swore they saw when they caught up to our grouping. And now, when I think back to our pre-race speech with a clear mind, the claims made sense, as much as I wanted to think it was all hearsay. A runner in the group behind me had been stabbed multiple times by another participant. The stone-faced man, the last runner in line, the transition of something that gleamed in the light. The facts added up, what the crowd relayed to us, what our fellow runners saw, the non-regulation statement. There was a madman on the course, and he was intent on slaughter. The runners that quit, scared off by the racer with the knife. The runners too injured to go on, cut up by the man the state media would later refer to as the mad knifer, a bit too juvenile for my taste. I wanted to press my pace, stake a distance between myself and the murdering maniac runner, but my endurance was nowhere near what I needed to sustain such a high speed and still finish the race. I had heard of the coalition pulling stunts before, inserting moles to punish underperforming labor forces, using those poor souls as public examples to motivate all the other citizens under the state's thumb. The coalition even believed in public executions to help further their law and order. But installing a knife-wielding runner among a group competing for the resurrection of a loved one, that seemed like a new low. And did I have to finish the race and risk being caught up to by this maniac? What would stop me from dropping out like some of the others had, self-preservation topping all else? It was possible. I just had to leave the course and blend into the crowd, and I'd be safe from the hunter. However, my bravado, my ego, told me otherwise. It told me I deserved this reward. It told me I deserved to see my father once more, to show him he was not forgotten. Even now, I think it was stupid. But damn it, I would do it again if I had to. At that point, my mind was made up. I would finish this race, or die trying. Or kill to cross the line? Finish first at all costs? This wasn't a regulated event. Fuck New America. Fuck the coalition. This was my race to win, and mine only. The crowds started to thicken along the course the closer we fought toward the finish line, the mass of spectators probably trying to catch a glimpse of the mad knifer gaining on the front runners. I kept a vigilant watch, scanning the other runners behind the lead group. It felt like we had padded the distance as we closed in on the end of the race. The marker denoting the final mile approached, and with it, my mind narrowed in on one thing only. Get across the finish line and get there first. I was in the lead, but I could see several runners in my peripheral nipping at my heels. I could feel the hot sweat dripping down my face, soaking through my bandana. The crowd began to roar with excitement. The hand of the runner next to me shot out, tried to grip my forearm. As the knife-wielding maniac plunged his weapon into the soft tissue of the runner's throat, a squirt of steaming blood splattered the side of my face as I turned to see more clearly the runner tumble to his knees, grasping at his neck. I looked to my right and witnessed another runner, stunned from the bloodletting we had both just witnessed, tangle up in his own feet and crash hard to the pavement. Adrenaline flushed through my body, and a sheet of chills blanketed my skin. I turned my neck and chanced a glance behind me. I saw the runner with the knife, blood up to the hilt, flinging off the slick steel with every pump of his arm. He was only 3 or 4 strides behind me. We were the only ones left. How had he caught up to me? Later, I forced myself to watch the rebroadcast of the run. The mad knifer made his way through the throng of runners with ease, starting from the back and methodically working his way forward as if stamina and endurance were of no issue to him. He closed the gap on the lead group with alarming quickness, and had I not been so focused that last mile on being the first to cross the finish line, I would have noticed the madman approaching me. After the two runners flanking me went down, It left the knifer and myself vying for the finish line. I could see it. It felt so close, I thought I could touch it. Only what I actually felt was the hot breath of the madman on my neck as he drafted behind me. I saw the blade come down within inches of my shoulder. My body froze, my legs skidding to a halt. The madman tumbled over me at full speed, sprawling out on the pavement while taking me down with him. I hit my head hard enough to see hundreds of little stars and felt a sticky substance cover my left eye. The gash in my forehead flowed like a river and partially blinded me, but I saw the knife mere feet from our collision. Instinct kicked in again, and I groped for the knife, picking it up as I straddled the exhausted man next to me. The blood from my forehead splashed down in droplets onto his cheeks. He braced my wrists with his hands as I hovered the knife inches above his face. We both trembled, muscles aching, as I threw my chest over my hands, using the force and weight of my body to drive the blade into the madman's eyeball. It slid in with a sickening slurp, and a strange, opaque fluid filled the reservoir of where his eye used to be when it finally popped. The screams from the madman mixed with the screams from the crowd surrounding us, and I couldn't differentiate between them. The knife finally came to rest with an inch of the blade still exposed as the man fell limp. I don't remember crossing the finish line. I watched myself do it on the rebroadcast, but I still don't remember it. The crowds cheered me on as I walked across, my head hung, and I was crying. I killed a man who tried to kill me, and I was grieving for him. I killed a man for the chance to bring another man back, the gravity of which didn't hit me until days later when I saw myself commit the heinous act. Sure, you could claim it was self-defense, but I could have easily popped up and run across the finish line with the knife in hand instead of turning it on the attacker. I would have won. I would have been safe. But I killed him, and I haven't stopped replaying that in my head. One night, a week later, my family and I were seated at the dinner table getting ready to dig into a tray of lasagna when the doorbell rang. My wife and I exchanged a glance, and I got up to answer it. When I pulled the door open, I saw my father, just the same as like looking at all the old photographs my mother had managed to keep. He hadn't aged a minute. The beard was the same, the glasses were the same, the thinning hairline, all the same. I tried to speak, my mouth opened, but no words came out. I heard a plate crash to the floor behind me as Lena saw the man at the door. "Hello, son," my father said. "Hello again." Tears welled up in my eyes, blurring my vision and creating a duplicate of the man in front of me. I nodded my head and mouthed the word hello. I reached my arms out and embraced him as he stepped inside. I hugged the man that I hadn't seen or touched or smelled in years. I buried my face into his neck and cried, sobs hitching in my throat, and he pulled me in tighter. In the threshold of the door, we stood, arms wrapped around each other, and it felt like we had an eternity in that moment, and I was ready to experience that eternity. My father patted the back of my head, and I tightened my embrace. I tightened it until I felt like I was squeezing too hard, too much, as the body inside his flannel shirt started to waste away. The hand patting my head began to feel like a bag of feathers caressing my scalp, before finally, the sensation of sand blew across and down my neck, and I knew his hand was gone. My own hands collapsed in on each other, wadding up my father's flannel shirt. His body had vanished. I pulled back and looked at my father's face one last time. He was still smiling as he turned dark, then ashy, and then disappeared. I dropped his shirt onto the pile with his jeans and sneakers below me. I fell to my knees. Lena came up behind me, placing her hands on my shoulders and her face on my back, as I picked up my father's shirt again, held it to my face, and breathed in. I cried.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
A month later, I received a letter in the mail with the LRC letterhead. It congratulated me on my win and for the chance to interact with a resurrected loved one again. It went on to explain the technology wasn't perfect. They were still working out bugs, but had made great strides, and it was because of people like me that they were able to continue in their research. It was obvious that the race was a bogus attempt to garner publicity for the state. They were, after all, God, and I was but a humble servant, a slave to my master who influenced my thoughts and dictated my decisions. To see my father again was an experience, even so briefly, that has helped the numbness of everyday life now. But, gone as soon as he arrived, it also reminded me of our own fragility and how delicate life is. I still see it sometimes, the blood on my hands. I wash and wash and wash until my skin is hot and raw, but it doesn't ever seem to come off. You've been listening to 20 Mile Chances by A.W. Mason. A.W. Mason lives in Florida with his cats Wallace and Belle, retired extreme parkour artists who look so dapper in their little helmets and knee pads. He enjoys all the nachos, getting lost in the woods, and naps. Mason has published several books, including A Haunt of Travels, The Cleanup Crew, The Scampering, co-authored with Alana K. Drex, and Judy Martin's Final Curtain Call. His short stories have appeared in various anthologies. Hey, listeners, stepping aside real quick to ask, are you listening to this on YouTube right now? If you are, it really helps us out if you would drop a like and maybe even leave a comment. Thank you for helping us feed the machine. Now, back to the story. Next, to close out our episode, here's The Swan by Jesse Pullins. I remember the day we met, seeing her sitting in the front yard, alone, eyeing the moving truck curiously as she fidgeted with a dirty stuffed animal, a little head of long blonde hair blowing in the wind. In a strange way, I think of it as a destined friendship, despite the two of us being doomed children in the middle of nowhere. It was the day I moved in with my grandmother, an unfortunate fresh start on the outskirts of town, far away from a normal life and even further from the empty house left behind after the death of my parents. My grandmother, long widowed by the loss of my grandfather, took me in with what I assumed as a child was welcomed and loving, but perhaps reluctantly unprepared arms. I would later learn that my grandmother was simultaneously serving as next and last of kin. After getting the bleak tour of my grandmother's cluttered house, she showed me to where I would start staying, a small room that laid bare save for a single bed and antique dresser. I only had a few boxes of things left to my name, ones that movers had stacked in the middle of the room to already clutter the only neat room in the house. I remember my grandmother telling me two things before leaving me to unpack alone. "You're very handsome. You look just like your grandfather." And, "Drunk driving is a sin, and whoever robbed you of your parents is rotting in hell." And with that, she left me in the incredibly dim room to make me something to eat. I remember just sitting on my bed and looking at the boxes, unsure if it mattered to actually open them. Losing your parents at 7 years old has a habit of making you painfully aware and dull. In the days of hushed adult whispers leading up to moving out of town, I contemplated the purpose of my continued existence in the absence of my parents. With everything feeling so dark, I didn't see the point of opening the boxes or doing anything at all. That was until I heard something hit my window. For a while, I just stared at the window, dumbfounded. There was nothing to do in this house, which seemed packed wall to wall with collectibles and a cabinet full of bottles that my grandfather had collected. No video games, no toys. From my sunken perch on the bed, I watched the window, wondering if I had actually heard the noise or just imagined it. Soon, the sound happened again, in the form of a rock hitting the window. When I gathered the courage to saunter over and look, I could see the girl from next door. She froze when I saw her, one hand poised to throw another pebble, the other holding the stuffed animal in the crook of her arm. When I opened the window, she dropped the pebble and came over, standing on her tippy toes to introduce herself.
"My name's Penny. Why are you here?"
she asked shyly, bouncing on her toes.
"I just moved in. My parents died," I said, mostly mumbling. "I'm sorry. My mommy ran away when I was a baby. You want to be friends?"
I didn't understand the bruises on her arms or why she had them. I didn't understand how dark and empty the world suddenly became, and why I still had to be a part of it. I didn't understand a lot when I was younger, but there was one thing I clearly understood. Penny and I would, in fact, be friends. It took me a while to come out of my shell, and I never fully made it back out. I didn't talk very much, something Penny accepted quickly. Neither of us spoke much, really. I remember we would play in her yard most of the time with whatever toys we had, with the understanding that I would never mistreat her stuffed animal. Despite it being dirty and ripped in places, Penny held it close at all times, no matter what we were doing.
"It's a swan," Penny would say. "My mommy gave it to me before she ran away."
It didn't look much like a swan, years of wear making it look more like a tired seagull. But Penny swore it was a swan, so I took her word for it. I remember asking her why her mother left, one of the first sentences spoken to her. She just shrugged and looked at the ground for a while, chewing her lip and holding the little swan close. Minutes would go by with her lost in thought, and I would just sit there and wait for her. Then she would perk up all of a sudden and ask to play tag or hide and seek. We would play day in and day out, usually until my grandmother called me for dinner. Penny would frown and watch me go, and I always felt bad for leaving. I would check on her during dinner, and she would just be sitting on her porch with her swan, or sometimes tossing rocks into the creek that made up half our backyards. I didn't know why she never liked being inside her house, and every time I mentioned her daddy, she didn't want to talk about it. Penny's daddy didn't come out of the house much. Whenever he did, it was usually to yell at Penny for being outside, although he always talked slowly and didn't make sense most of the time. He would always be tired, and he would always be angry. It would be years before I understood that her daddy was a drunk, and that he liked to beat on her. Things like that have a habit of sitting on the back burner when you're little. I mentioned the bruises to my grandmother, and she said we shouldn't talk about it, that it was their business. Penny didn't want to talk about it either, so I pretended not to see them. In retrospect, I think my grandmother knew and wanted to help. She just didn't know how. She would do things to try and make it better every once in a while, like invite her over for dinner when her father was asleep, or bring her sweets discreetly when she had been baking. I remember on an especially bad day, Penny had a busted lip, and my grandmother said something like, "He's all she's got. Sometimes you just have to hang in until things get better." There was something so sad about how she said it, and I could tell she was trying not to cry. I remember everything feeling sad and gray for a long time, but the sadness wouldn't be so bad if I could see my grandmother and Penny smile. In my bleak home in the middle of nowhere, I decided if they were happy with how things were, maybe I could learn to be happy too.
As the years passed, things started to get better, a little. When I opened up a bit more, I started calling my grandmother Gran, which seemed to make her happy. Gran didn't speak of my grandfather much beyond the fact that he enjoyed collecting rare bottles of whiskey. He never drank them, which didn't make much sense to me. Gran said some people collected strange things, and she was just thankful he didn't collect guns instead. Even though he had passed years ago, she still kept the cabinet clean and dusted. I would spend nights looking at the old bottles, trying to imagine my grandfather holding them when I read the label. Penny and I became great friends, a friendship that lasted even after we started going to school. We would ride the bus together, an old rickety shuttle that would take us to a school I didn't much care for. It's not because I didn't have my old friends there anymore, but because the other kids weren't interested in being our friends. Penny and I were the same age as all the other kids, but they just treated us differently. I would often hear them whisper nasty things to each other, sometimes about Penny, sometimes about me. They would often whisper of the marks and bruises Penny seemed to have, the ones I had gotten used to not acknowledging. They would talk about how she wore the same clothes a lot, and how often they were dirty. They would talk about how I didn't have a mom and dad, and sometimes speculate over what happened to them. Sometimes they would say I killed them. Other times they would say they didn't love me anymore because I was bad. The teachers would hush and scold them, but they would always say something again. They would always leave us out of activities and pretend they didn't see us. In time, I found that I hated school, but as long as the two of us could play together once we got home, everything would be all right. At the end of every gloomy day, we had each other. The older I got, the more I came to terms with the loss of my parents. The void they left behind never truly filled, but Gran did her best to raise me and be there for me. Some days were worse than others, and Penny had a habit of picking up on it and finding ways to cheer me up. In return, I was always there for her when she needed me, although I wasn't as good at noticing. Penny would always let me know, however, in the form of a pebble hitting my window. We would sneak out some nights, something that proved easy with how early Gran always went to bed and how drunk Penny's father always was. We would tiptoe through the shallow creek and duck under the trees that grew along it, keeping quiet until we reached the cornfield that started at the end of our property. The corn would stretch for miles over the hills, but before that was a tiny patch that never sprouted like it should. It was our little secret spot, a nice place where we could lay down and look at the stars and hear the cicadas chirp. Our own little paradise, away from the things that reminded us of how bad it was. Just me, her, and her stuffed swan. Laying down in the squashed and malformed cornstalks, we would talk about our dreams. I would tell her about my dreams, where there was no car accident and everything was full color again. Penny would listen, propped up on her elbow with a little smile, holding her sad, seagull-looking stuffed animal close and smiling as I talked. In that moment, I could lift up the weight that was on my shoulders and let some semblance of light in. I could talk to her in a way that I couldn't with Gran, with her mutual understanding of a parent blinking out of sight. I would speak of my dreams, and when I was finished, she would touch my arm and say, "That was lovely," in her adolescent country accent. I would roll over and wait as she looked at the stars, snuggling her stuffed animal that looked sadder and sadder as time moved on. She would close her eyes and think for a moment, putting together the full memory she always managed to recollect. When she opened them, I remember seeing the reflection of the moon in her eyes, her little globes wide and marveling at the shining sky above. Penny would tell me how she dreamt of being a swan. It was a dream she had often, one I would get to know and love more every time she told it. She would tell me she dreamt of dancing among the stars as a swan, spreading her wings and flying across the sky. Up above would be a world free of pain and suffering, a world full of light that would shine so brightly it would erase the pain of everything you'd been through. In her dream, she could stretch her legs and run as far away as she wanted, feeling the wind on her feathers as she soared across the sky. She said that in her dream, if she flew far enough, she would find her mother. I watched her tell her story, the reflection of the stars glinting in her eyes. She would look happy, and the smile she wore while telling her story would put me at ease and momentarily dull the feeling of loss and longing for days to come. It didn't matter how rough things were at school or how empty it felt at home. I would think of Penny the Swan, and I would feel better. Just as sleep would try and take me, Penny would help me up and tell me it was time to go home. Together, we would duck back under the trees and mind our footing through the creek, hoping we could creep back home just as soundlessly as we had left. Things continued as normal into middle school. I wasn't interested in having other friends. Whenever I finished my schoolwork, I took to books rather than socializing. Talking to others wasn't something I was particularly good at, and even if I was good at conversation, we didn't have anything in common. Gran didn't have a lot of money, so I was out of touch with whatever video game or movie craze everyone seemed to chat about. As Penny grew older, she learned to embrace her independence at home and spent a lot of time taking better care of herself and her home. Her clothes were much cleaner, and she spent a lot of time keeping her long hair straight and untangled. Gran did whatever she could to make sure she had essentials like toothbrushes and a decent conditioner, and whenever she bought clothes for me, she always tried to sneak in something for her as well. The school counselors knew what was happening at home, and sometimes reached out and made some attempt to address the issue. Penny's father would get better for a time. The bruises would stop, and things would feel better. But it never lasted long, and after a while, I supposed they stopped seeing the bruises like I once had. Maybe it was easier for them. When things were especially bad, I would hear the pebble hit my window. We would go to our secret spot and talk of our dreams, the one thing that would always reset things for a time. But as I got older, I dreamed of my parents less and thought more of Penny finding another home, one where things weren't so bad all the time. Penny still talked of the same dream, her dream of being a swan. It still held the same radiance as it always did, but it made me feel different when I heard it now. Now, when she told it, I wished that somehow it could come true. The summer after I turned 13, things started to change. It was a hot day in July, and I had just finished mowing the yard for Gran. It was the first nice day after a long string of rain, and the creek had gone up above knee level for the first time in years. Penny was hanging out in the grass, drawing a picture of the sad-looking swan stuffed animal. She still carried it around from time to time, but it was hardly recognizable and falling apart. The eyes were barely holding on, and the fur had shed so much in spots it was bald. It was sweltering out, and Gran suggested we swim in the creek since we didn't have a sprinkler or anything. It was something we hadn't done since we were little. "Last one there's a rotten egg!" Penny yelled, leaving her swan and drawings in the yard. Penny didn't have a swimsuit, so we both went in with our clothes on. The water was freezing, so we took turns splashing each other and running away. Gran watched from the top of the hill, laughing as we trounced through the creek. Penny was wearing shorts and one of her father's old t-shirts, one so long her knees would catch on it in the water. It would slow her down when she fought with it, so I would always be able to get away. We went back and forth for a while, splashing and jumping, until Gran called from atop the hill and said she was going to go back inside to make us some lemonade. When Gran was gone, Penny told me to turn around and cover my eyes. I teased her about it, thinking she would use the opportunity to try and get the jump on me. She swore she wouldn't cheat, and after going back and forth, I sighed and did as she asked. Behind me, I heard her messing with something, giggling in between the sounds of her straining with something. After a wet plap on the water, she told me to turn around and open my eyes. I lowered my hands and turned around to see she had taken off her shirt. I had never really looked at a girl before, let alone seen or even really knew what a bra was, and Penny used my awkward double take to her advantage. "See if you can outrun me now," she said before bolting through the water. Penny tackled me before I could get away, sending us both into the chilly water. We rolled and flailed, splashing each other through bouts of laughter. Penny tried to hold me under the water, and I tried to escape, taking turns as the water murked beneath us. We went back and forth, wrestling and laughing until we collapsed from exhaustion, both of us gasping and giggling on our butts in the water. I don't know if it was the special glint in her eyes or the curve of her smile, but it felt different, like a jar of fireflies had been released in my stomach. Penny scrunched her face and pulled her knees to her chest, suddenly looking embarrassed. "What?" she said, blushing as she looked away and wiped the long, matted strands of hair from her face. She looked up at the hill and froze, the color draining just as quickly as it arrived. I could then hear the footsteps. On the hill was her father, his glazed eyes holding a dead stare.
"It's not... we were just..."
Penny stammered, scrambling for her discarded shirt. Penny's father yanked her out of the creek by her hair, dragging her up the hill as she screamed and kicked. I wanted to stop him, but I was scared, and he was so much bigger than me.
"You're a whore, just like your mother! You want to run away, just like she did?"
he shouted in her ear, holding her up with a fistful of hair. When Penny didn't answer, he only got angrier. He tried instigating more, but Penny stayed quiet, sobbing softly as she reached for her yanked hair. He looked around angrily, eyes wild as he sought someone else to inflict his rage upon. At first, he looked at me, but was distracted when he saw the stack of papers. With a scowl, he let her go and shambled over to the drawings, grabbing all of them in crinkled handfuls. He stared at the pictures of swans, looking over each one with his puffy eyes. Without a word, he ripped them to pieces, scattering them to the wind as Penny cried on the ground. Just when I thought his tantrum was finished, he saw the stuffed animal and snatched it up with a grunt. Penny begged him to stop, but it only seemed to fuel his rage. He twisted the stuffed swan's head until it tore, then pulled it apart until the stuffing scattered across the yard. When she tried to stop him, he slapped her, a vicious echo that seemed to carry for miles. I remember Gran coming out of the house and dropping the lemonade, pleading with Penny's father that we were just kids. He and Gran shouted at each other, and in the end, Gran sat and started crying. I remember looking at Penny for a moment and feeling guilty that I had looked at her like I did. I didn't understand what her father meant when he said those things to her, but I felt like it was my fault. Like maybe if I hadn't looked at her like I did, maybe she wouldn't have gotten in trouble. After he dragged Penny into the house and slammed the door shut, he yelled at her for a while. I wished there was something I could do. I remember getting out of the creek and Gran just sitting there saying, I'm sorry, over and over, rocking back and forth. I didn't understand why she was sorry. I didn't understand any of it. I spent the rest of the afternoon staring out my window, looking at Penny's house. In my hands was the torn-up stuffed animal, mangled and deflated beyond recognition. The pictures had all blown away before I could grab them, the wind growing fierce as the sunshine turned to an ugly, overcast gray. By the time the yelling had subsided, it started to rain, and I found myself looking through the downpour at Penny's window, hoping she was all right. Looking at her house gave me a terrible feeling, a dread that I couldn't describe. I was used to the way things were for Penny, but for some reason, this time felt worse. When my eyes grew too heavy, I curled up on my bed. I looked at the stuffed swan as I drifted off to sleep, praying that somewhere in the noise of the storm, I would hear the sound of a pebble hitting the glass. Hours later, I found my prayer had been answered. I opened my eyes to the soft tink of the pebble, the familiar chime that found me even through the barrage of rain and wind.
I sat up immediately, throwing off the covers and grabbing the stuffed swan to meet Penny at the window. I could see her through the glass, a pale silhouette through the film of spattering rain. I opened the window and was hit by a chilly gust that sucked the warmth from my room. I motioned for Penny quietly, and she hurried over, holding a hand up against the pelting mist. Her nightgown was soaked, and her hair was matted and tangled. She leaned against the window, shivering, her hands trembling on the windowsill.
"Penny, are you all right? I was so worried."
I started to whisper, but stopped. Something was wrong. The way she was looking down, the way her bottom lip trembled. Her cheery perseverance was gone, and in its place, a cold and broken shell. I reached for her, and she flinched away, shuddering against the storm as she hugged herself. I waited for her to say something, but I got my answer when she looked up. The left side of her face had been horribly beaten. Her left eye was swollen shut, accompanied by a dark purple bruising that went from the top of her cheek to the corner of her mouth. I felt the tears immediately, along with a sudden sickening pull in my stomach.
"Penny, no."
My whisper was hushed by a clammy finger and a feigned smile.
"It's okay. It doesn't hurt much. Not anymore," she said,
but her eyes told a different story. I looked past her to the storm outside, unable to see the creek through the stormy night.
"Are you sure you want to go to our spot? I don't think we'll be able to see the stars. You want to just come inside?"
I asked, but she shook her head.
"No, there's something I want to show you. We'll be able to see, I'm sure, but I need you to do me a favor first. I don't have much time, but it'll be worth it, I promise," she said, and I nodded.
Penny told me she needed a bottle of whiskey from my grandfather's cabinet. She told me she felt bad for asking, but it was the only way to buy enough time for us to get away. She said it was important, and she would only have one chance to do it. I agreed, wanting to do whatever I could to help her. Penny hid at the window as I crept away, glancing back to her house nervously as I disappeared down the hall. I didn't know what time it was, but I knew it was late. I tiptoed down the hall, the sounds of a late-night game show coming in clearer as I drew near. Gran had a habit of falling asleep while watching television, and I hoped the storm hadn't woken her. I peeked into the living room to see her asleep, the television's glow flickering as she snored softly in her recliner. As quietly as I could, I walked in front of the screen towards my grandfather's collectible cabinet. I opened it slowly, keeping an eye on Gran as its squeaking blended with the applause of someone winning a grand prize. I grabbed the highest bottle I could reach, the weight of it feeling dirty in my hands. I closed the cabinet, and Gran mumbled as the program went to commercial. After stirring under her blanket, the dry rasp of snoring continued. She was sound asleep. I tucked the bottle under my shirt, feeling guilty. I snuck back to my room and anxiously closed the door behind me. I was sick with worry and scared that I might find Penny's father looking in when I went back to the window. Instead, I saw nothing, only the occasional flash of lightning illuminating the black outside, an empty yard glistening in the rain.
"Penny?"
I whispered, creeping up to the window. I poked my head outside, holding both the whiskey and the torn stuffed animal. Droplets pelted my face as I looked around, my stomach twisting as I saw nothing but wet grass.
"I'm here."
I jumped as Penny came up beside me, still shivering in her soaked nightgown. I asked her if she wanted a blanket or something, but she shook her head. I handed the bottle to her and she took it, cradling it like a glass baby. She looked down at the bottle in sadness, her untouched eye lingering on it before she turned back to me. I held the stuffed animal out next. Penny looked at the broken swan, her lip trembling into a frown as the rain hit it.
"I don't need it anymore," she said, and managed a faint smile. "Thank you for helping me. I shouldn't be long. You should bundle up. It's cold out here," she said, and kissed me on the cheek.
I stood there dumbfounded.
"You're the best friend I've ever had," she said, and then scurried back to her house. After she slinked in through the back door, I still felt the press of the kiss on my cheek. I looked at the little swan in my hand, feeling a whirlwind of emotions within me. I didn't know what was happening, or how I was supposed to feel about it. I shut the window, set the swan on my dresser, and started putting on warmer clothes. Outside, the storm pressed on. I pulled on jeans and a sweatshirt, occasionally looking out my window to Penny's house. Her house stood eerily silent in the storm, and with no light inside, it was impossible to know what was going on. I got some boots from the closet, thinking they would be better walking through the rain. After I put them on, I got in bed and covered myself in a blanket while I waited for Penny to return. I laid in the dark for a while, listening to the patter of rain. I thought of Penny and the kiss she gave me. I thought of her father and the wild look in his eyes. I thought of Gran and how she took me in. After a while, I thought of my parents and how it was harder to see their faces as time went on. As I busied myself with my thoughts, the rain settled down to a drizzle, and the thunder was getting farther and farther apart. The wind no longer rattled the siding, and soon an agitated peace settled in. And with it, a pebble. Penny was waiting by the window when I got there, still in the same damp nightgown. She looked tired and cold, but determined. She held a finger to her lips before I could say anything. Then I nodded and climbed out the window. She took my hand and led me to the backyard, her bare feet and my boots squishing in the wet grass. Her grip was cold but fierce, but she looked back with a smile that assured me everything would be okay. The storm was fading, and on the horizon, the dawn fought to poke through the gloom. Together, we went down the hill leading to the creek, holding each other up each time the earth slid beneath us. The creek was rushing from the rain, but Penny didn't let it slow her down. She was focused, pushing through steadily as I held on tight. My boots sucked at the mud, but I kept up, sucking in a breath as the cold water passed by my legs like ice. We made it through, both of us huffing with excited exhaustion. As I caught my breath, she let go of my hand and ducked into the trees that led to our secret spot. I looked back at our houses, the mental noise of the pain they brought fading the further we got away. When I finally ducked in, Penny had already reached the edge of the woods. She motioned for me to follow and then disappeared into the corn. I trailed after quickly, clumsily soaked boots trudging through with every step. I tried to keep my focus ahead, watching the corn get closer and closer, trying to keep up. With the faint light of dawn, I noticed something in the mud beneath me. It didn't make sense at first, but the longer I looked, I started to notice a pattern. Two sets of bare feet were imprinted in the mud, two facing in the direction of our houses, two facing the cornfield. A single smear drug between them. The path led all the way to our secret spot. Once I reached the corn, I saw a single patch of disturbed stalks. Some of them had been flattened or broken, a path the smear ran directly through. On the other side of the corn, I could see the outline of Penny waiting patiently. As I wove my way through the stalks, I started to hear something, like an incoherent mumbling. It got louder the closer I got, the mumbling turning into groaning, then mumbling again. When I finally made it through, there was Penny. She walked over silently, took my hand, and smiled, pulling me into a hug with both arms. She was still cold, but she wasn't shivering anymore. I had never hugged her before, and it was then that I realized how thin she actually was, like she was sick. She rested her head on my shoulder for a while, and for a moment, we just held each other in the peaceful dawn. She looked up at me and smiled, half of her face beaming, the other unable to. She touched my face, running her thumb over my cheek softly before looking to the sky. Above, the stars were shining, brighter than ever before.
"Thank you for coming with me. Thank you for letting me show you," she said,
and it was then I saw the wriggling shape behind her. On the ground was Penny's father, writhing. Lodged in his mouth was the bottle of whiskey, a heavy wrap of duct tape keeping it in place. The bottle was empty. She stepped out of the way so I could see better. Her smile faded to a blank slate of indifference. I looked at her father in surprise, instinctively stepping away from him. Penny held my hand tight and kept me by her side. Her father tried to struggle but couldn't, his unfocused eyes lolling at the sky as he fought against makeshift restraints of clothing and belts. Dribbles of vomit caked his face, and he seemed caught in a constant state of heavy gasping, though the gasps were attempts at words, each of them heavily slurred and muffled by the lodged bottle. Before long, my gaze was pulled away from him, behind him. A wide mass stirred in front of the corn, a shape almost concealed by the haze of the leaving nightfall. It moved with the sound of an ocean wave, its size expanding on each side until I could see long, elegant feathers fan out like daggers. A long neck rose from its body, curving and extending until it towered above. A head the size of my body looked directly at me, then started leaning toward me. A neon glow burst from the horizon, painting the shape as it encroached towards me. The giant swan stood with stark brilliance, its ballerina shape menacing and pure. Pitch black eyes narrowed on me, its massive and elegant beak poised and ready to stab me through the chest. I looked up at it helplessly, squeezing Penny's hand as I resisted the urge to let my bladder go. The beak kept reaching toward me, and when it was almost close enough to touch, it stopped. Penny reached out and placed her hand on the beak, and the colossal bird froze. It turned to her slowly, and she stepped forward to rest her head against the feathers on its neck. The animosity faded away, and the swan relaxed. It leaned into Penny's embrace, and the stars glimmered in the static above. There was a deep humming in the swan's breast, and Penny smiled. Before I could relax, the swan looked back at me and softly prodded me in the chest with its beak. I looked at Penny, and she nodded, and with a trembling hand, I reached out to pet its neck. Each feather soft as the finest silk, but brimming with electrical energy, like I was touching a battery. When I looked into its eyes, I felt like it was looking into my soul. When the swan was done with me, there was a deep hum, and then it craned its head to look at Penny's father. The man lay miserably on the ground, still mumbling through his vomit. He tried to look around, but there was an absence in his eyes. Each thrash was confused and belligerent, resisting without knowing why. He didn't see the swan, even when it came for him. The beak parted as it reached his torso, then clamped down slowly like a vise. He screamed as it pinched together, breaking the restraints and peeling his flesh effortlessly. The swan's bite took everything with it, ripping layers of skin and muscle and leaving an exposed chest cavity in its wake. It reared back and swallowed the viscera, the mass sliding down its tube of a neck. I wanted to run. I looked at Penny and gasped. Penny's mouth was open wide, her jaws struggling as she bared her teeth. They kept opening until her jaw broke, a terrible wet crunch that brought tears to my eyes. She was looking at me, a single tear falling before her eye disappeared, buried under folds as her face scrunched and folded together, making way for what was forcing itself out of her throat. A long bill, blood-stained and burnt orange, kept protruding until it crowned a head. Penny's head separated to accommodate the expunging mass, and I watched in horror as her body tore vertically and a pair of stained wings stretched from the remnants of her shoulders. The strings of her nightgown snapped, revealing a feathery breast speckled with red. I held on until there was nothing left to hang on to, and could only watch as short, paddled feet stepped out of the gore. The swan that burst from Penny walked awkwardly at first, but after a few steps, balanced on newfound feet. It looked up at the giant swan, who nodded from above. Penny's father was still trying to scream, but his strength was fading. His chest was a mess of flayed pectoral muscle, shifting organs, and a beating heart struggling to stay inside its ruined containment. I watched as the baby swan walked over to him, its dark eyes looking down thoughtfully, right before it dug into his chest. The beak was sharp, separating the tissue as it rooted around. Penny's father thrashed weakly, unable to defend himself. When the beak found his heart, it pinched and ripped it free, holding it up triumphantly before rearing back and dropping it down its throat. Arterial spray scattered in all directions, staining feathers and corn alike. When the baby was finished, it backed away from the corpse, the bulge of the heart still working its way down its throat. The giant swan reached down and gave an affectionate embrace. The sun burst through the tree line, and tantalizing pink and orange painted the sky. They stood there like sculptures, like masterpieces from carved diamonds that reflected the light of the sun. It was beautiful. When they were done, the swans looked at each other, and then looked at me. The smaller one looked back at the mother and stood awkwardly, shuffling on its paddled feet. The mother scoffed and nudged the baby over to me. It walked hesitantly at first, but eventually approached, its wings held bent in front of it. The mother turned and scooped up the rest of the man on the ground, gathering him up in one large, delicate bite. I looked at the small swan, then looked at what remained of Penny. Whatever was left was fading into the grass, withering away like ash on a campfire. I looked at the remains, feeling a ball in my throat and a heaviness in my chest. The swan reached out a wing and blocked my view of it, its dark eyes looking upset. It exhaled through its nasal passages in a way that felt sympathetic. I reached out for it, and it leaned against me, its long neck resting on my shoulder as its wings stretched out and wrapped around me. Through the blood and feathers, I felt the embrace of Penny, a kind soul meant for a better world. The swan whistled softly, and I started to cry, throat-aching sobs that I couldn't hold back. The swan hummed softly, swaying with me. We stood like this until my tears ran dry, and the swan pulled away to rejoin its mother. I wiped my eyes and watched her go, the haze of the sun lifting the weight of the pain I had gotten so used to ignoring. Together, they stretched their wings, thousands of feathers casting shadows over the corn, and with one grand flap, they were gone. Ever since she was a kid, Penny dreamed of being a swan. It was a dream she had often, one I would get to know and love more every time she told it. She would tell me she dreamt of dancing among the stars, spreading her wings and flying across the sky. Up above would be a world free of pain and suffering, a world full of light that would shine so brightly it would erase the pain of everything she'd been through. I'm older now, and things are much better than they used to be. I learned to have another family, one that wouldn't have to know the pain of a broken home, and don't have to wonder if they belong. Sometimes I go out at night and look up at the stars. I think of Penny the swan, and if I look hard enough, I can see her flying with her mother. You've just heard The Swan by Jesse Pullins.
Jesse Pullins is an American short fiction writer and Hawaiian shirt enthusiast from the Midwest. With a love for horror and suspense, he draws heavy inspiration from retro video games and classic creepypastas. And with that, my dear friends, our storytelling time is over for this week. My thanks go out to A.W. Mason and Jesse Pullins for their contributions this evening, and I'd like to mention that you can find more work from both of these authors over at Velux Books, www.velluxbooks.com. That should keep you nice and busy until next week, when I'll be back with more stories to keep you cozy on these increasingly cold nights. Until then, listeners, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.